All right, hello, welcome everyone. I'm Erin Schaefer. I'm the graduate assistant over at the Women's Center. I'd like to welcome you to our Fall 2010 Women on Wednesday series, Workplace Justice, Women at Work. This is the Women's 21st year of offering the Women on Wednesday series, which has evolved over the years from an informal brown bag lunch series to a more formal lecture series. Over the years, we've stayed true to our goal of highlighting the voices of a diverse, intelligent, savvy, and creative group of women. Their expertise has covered a broad range of topics on political, social, legal, and economic issues affecting women's lives. This semester series covers a variety of issues crucial to the lives of women in the workplace, including pay equity, discrimination of various isms, sexual harassment, work-life balance, leadership, and more. A few items before we get started, please turn off your cell phones, and also please remain seated until 12:50 as a courtesy to our speaker. Also, if you could please fill out the evaluation sheet, we use this for future programming. Our session today is titled, Work-Life Balance, Creating the Life We Envision. Women now comprise more than half of the U.S. labor market, obtain 58% of bachelor degrees, and work outside of the home in record numbers in Minnesota. Today's talk will explore the costs, benefits, choices, and challenges for women striving for work-life balance. Our speaker today is Dr. Teresa Rothausen. Dr. Rothausen is a professor of management in the University of St. Thomas's Opus College of Business, USTOCB, with primary responsibility as leader development professor in the full-time UST MBA program, from which students are hired by local and international organizations as the next generation of business leadership. She teaches courses in leadership, management, intercultural and diversity management, and human resources management. She conducts research in the areas of leader development, satisfaction, performance, retention, intercultural and diversity management, global human behavior, work-family and work-life interfaces, MBA education, career development, fit, recruit, and selection, and other person-organization interfaces. Dr. Rothausen also consults primarily in the areas of leader development and human capacity / optimizing human capital with a variety of businesses. Dr. Rothausen holds a PhD in human resources and industrial relations with specialties in staffing, training, and development and the organizational behavior organization theory from the University of Minnesota, and a BA in economics from St. Olaf College, and a CPA. We are very grateful to have her here with us today. Please join the Women's Center in welcoming Dr. Rothausen.
Good afternoon. How's everyone doing? Good? Good. Thanks for being here on a beautiful day in an auditorium with no windows. I think that speaks to your dedication to the topic and to learning more about this topic. I appreciate you having me here, so thank you for inviting me down from St. Thomas to speak to you. I'm going to experiment a little with my technology here. Let me know if at any time you can't hear me. The title of my talk that I was asked to speak to by the Women's Center is Work-Life Balance, Creating the Life We Envision, which I thought was an excellent title. And it's something that we all have to do as human beings is to have the best outcomes, we kind of have to plan to have them and head in a particular direction. At the same time, we have to kind of stay open to what life brings us. When I was sitting in your shoes in school, I had a pretty clear vision, and I thought I knew exactly how life was going to unfold, but it threw me a few curveballs. So it's kind of like entrepreneurship. I come from a school that specializes in entrepreneurship, and when I talk to entrepreneurs, they say, I'm always in the first year of a five-year plan. So it's not that they don't plan. They plan out 5 years, but they just never quite get past the first year till they have to create a new five-year plan, and that's how my work-life balance has kind of been. This is kind of a standard slide for me when I'm giving presentations or talks, but given the topic of this particular conversation, I also wanted to add my other roles. I think I pressed it twice. So I am a professor and I am a consultant, and I'll talk a little more about some of those things too that Erin introduced, but I'm also a mother of three. I have children who are 23, 20, and a senior in high school. Two sons and a daughter. I have a stepson. I have a husband. I have three furry children. I'm a homeowner. I like to travel. I've also written some fiction. I actually have one short story published and a couple of other things in the works. And I'm a swimmer and a hiker and a lot of things, just like all of you are. And I think it's important, oftentimes when we give these talks, we only talk about our work side. But I want to give you some information today that's primarily based on research. But I also want to intersperse in there my own experience with this, because I think maybe one of the reasons I was invited was not only because I do research on work family and work life, but because I've lived it, as you can see here from my mini vita. So to get started, kind of even to warm up my brain for a new audience, I like to kind of understand who's in the audience. So would you raise your hand if you're an undergraduate student here? So the majority, I'd say. Thank you. Would you raise your hand if you're a graduate student here? A couple? All right, good. And any MBA students here? No MBAs. Well, that's who I usually teach. Love MBAs, but love a lot of different kinds of students too. So I was just curious if my usual audience was in here at all. And I want to tell you a little bit more about me, because I think what I say about work-life balance comes partly from research, and it's data-driven, and it's based on data that I've collected and a lot of my colleagues have collected and work that we've done collectively, but it's also based to some extent on my life experience, just like all of our positions and the way we talk about things is. So I'll talk a little bit more about that. But to get our brains warmed up, I wanted to define this. You know, professors, we're really big on defining things. Before you talk about something, you better know what you're talking about, because otherwise you end up talking past each other. So to make sure that you know what I think I'm talking about, let's talk about this a little. First, focusing on the word balance. What comes to mind when you think of balance? Anyone want to just throw out a couple words?
Stable. Stability.
Okay, the opposite of stability or being stable?
No, being stable.
Okay, so balance is being stable. Okay, anything else that comes to mind?
Equal.
Equal? Okay, so there's a balance. There's some equal parts of different things that are balancing out, kind of. Okay, anything else? Well, when I search for images, just to kind of, again, get my brain warmed up, that's the equal thing, I think, kind of like you're taking more than one thing and you're trying to balance it. You're seeing which part is higher or lower, if they equal out, if they're equal, if they're balanced. But there were more images like this. That's why I asked you about stability. When people talk about balance, it's usually from a reference of I'm out of balance and I'm trying to get balance. So how do I get stability when I feel like I'm walking this tightrope or on the balance beam? So when I searched images of balance, the most of the ones I found were of this kind of image. There's a more modern version. This is all about kind of trying to get from one place to another on a kind of a narrow, tricky path. And so that's one word for balance that I think a lot of us who've been trying to balance our studies with full-time jobs and graduate school or undergrad or kids or whatever can relate to. So that's one image. Oops, pressed the wrong button. And this one I thought was great, because this is what I often felt like as I was going through my 20s, 30s, and beyond. I won't say how far beyond. But, you know, you're trying to juggle a lot of balls while you're kind of trying to keep going on a certain path that you have set for your life or a certain overall set of goals that you want to have. But you've got a lot of balls in the air. So this is one sense of balance. But then that kind of makes me feel a little bit worked up inside or a little bit chaotic. So I really like this other image of balance. This is another image that came up for balance that I think maybe some of us can really feel more calm and peace about when we see it. And it, to some extent, I felt as I was going through my own personal work, family, and work-life balance that from day to day, I was kind of like this lady here on the bike, juggling a lot of things, my kids, my job, my students, my research, and a lot of things. But then in my quiet moments, I felt that I had more of this other kind of balance because I was doing that during the day. And I could think about how full my life felt because I was engaged in all those different types of things. So I think a lot of times what we're talking about when we're talking about work-life balance is how do I fit everything that I want to fit into my life into it in a way that doesn't make me crazy and doesn't make balls drop all around me. Is that kind of what you think of when you think of work-life balance, or am I way off on what you want to hear about? Is that what you want to hear about? If you don't, tell me another vision of what work-life balance is. Anyone? Mostly nods. So we're on the same page. All right. So I want to talk a little bit about me, and most of this talk is going to be focused on research, but as a little bit of background, I know I wasn't expecting as long of an introduction as I got, so I'll skip over this pretty quick. But I have to balance things in my professional life as well. I'm a teacher, first of all. with undergrad and MBA students. I also do research, which I'll talk about more, and I'm a consultant. I work with different organizations. And as any of the faculty in the room, how many faculty in the room? Yay, there's some faculty, all right. Administrators and staff in the room. A few, good, welcome. As you can probably understand from working in a university, the higher up you go as a professor, the more you end up on committees and doing other kinds of leadership. So in my own professional life, I'm also juggling a lot of different things and trying to balance things. Here are some of the organizations with which I've been affiliated over the years, which I think also impact my experience of work life. I started off, I think, as Aaron said, I had a CPA, I worked for Arthur Anderson, and yes, we were ethical back then. They were ethical. There were some issues. That organization no longer exists because of ethical concerns. I had my own business consultancy for a while. One of my clients was Hennepin County Medical Center. Then I went back to school at the U, went to Texas A&M to teach for a while, and I've been at St. Thomas for over 10 years now. And again, when I was here at St. Olaf, I was sitting in the seats that you're sitting in, and I really felt like I kind of had a plan. I wanted to have it all, and I'd figure out the rest later. I think most young women today are smarter than I was. They're more realistic about understanding what it takes to balance. But we all come from a certain family background that influences how we think about that. So what I'm going to try to give you is a perspective that's broad from the whole research base on this issue. In addition, I think one of the reasons I was asked is I do research on work family. So you can see a lot of the front pages of some of my research articles here, which are on work family. And I also want to offer that if anyone is really interested in this topic or you want to do your senior thesis on this topic, there's people in psychology, sociology, anthropology, history, women's studies doing work. That's one of the things I like about this field is it's very multidisciplinary. So from your academic perspective, it's something that you can specialize in for your senior theses and graduate students, especially you already know this if you're in the Women's Center. This is a whole field now within academia, and business schools are more recent additions to the study of this. So that's one of my roles with research. These are some of the clients I've worked with, just FYI, so you understand kind of where I'm coming from. Mostly corporate America, but there are some nonprofits there. Some of these groups I've worked with pro bono. Other ones I charge fees to work with them. And I work with them on different things around leader development and human capacity consultancy. And I really think leader development includes work-life balance. If leaders aren't balanced, if they have nothing else in their lives, there can be a lot of implications not only for them, but for the whole organizations they're leading and for their followers. I'm also a teacher. I'm not going to read all those, but you can see the kind of classes that I teach, primarily at the graduate level, but I've taught a lot at the undergraduate level in the past. And I wanted to point out that this article here is the source of the handout that you have, you should have with a lot of boxes and arrows. You don't have to understand all that yet because we're going to kind of walk through that. But recently that paper won second place for best paper of 2009 in that journal. So I was pretty excited about that. So I've had some success in that area of my life as well. I was also the founding director of the full-time MBA program. So administrators, I can relate to you too. The dean asked me to step out of facultyhood and step into administration. So I started and ran the new full-time MBA program for a few years. Then step back to the professorship. So you can see I've been balancing a lot of things and doing a lot of things in my professional life. And in terms of service, I have some leadership roles as well. And then this is my other side of my life that I balance. I wanted to make it more visual. I have three kids. The first one is 23, and he is kind of an artist type, trying to find his way, but he's independent. He lives in a tiny studio apartment and earns enough money to just pay for it. My second son, on the other hand, owns his own house at age 20. They're very different. And there's my daughter, who's the senior at a college tour, which you can probably relate to. So this is some of the other things that I balance in my life, as well as trying to have fun, trying to stay healthy, trying to enjoy nature and lots of other kinds of things. And I'm sure that many of you also have all these kinds of things that you're juggling. So what can the research help us build fuller lives? How can the research help us do that? What do we know from research that might help us? That's going to be what I'm going to focus on. And occasionally I'll use my own life as an example of some of these issues. So we talked about balance. Now let's talk about what work-life really means. And what does the research tell us about that piece of the talk? We're talking about work-life balance. Well, why is this even an issue? In pre-industrial times, before we had factories and before we had big production lines, work and life were not separated. People often lived on farms or in agricultural economies. Their family was their business. So their family was their business unit. They worked together to produce what it took to live, whether it was food directly or whether they owned a store in a small town that the farmers came and bought things from. Everyone worked at that store, oftentimes small businesses, occasionally with employees, but pre-industrial times, most of the economics of our society in the U.S. and many other Western societies was very much woven into life. So if you would have gone back 125 years and said to somebody, how do you balance your work and your life? They'd go, what are you talking about? If I can relax on Sunday for a while, I do that. Is that what you mean? Because that every day, everything that people did, they worked in the fields with their sons or daughters, probably their sons. They worked in the kitchen with their daughters, or sometimes their sons, but probably their daughters, because there was a gender division of labor always, but work and life were not separated. So what happened? Well, we had the Industrial Revolution, and at that point, work was segregated. And when you think about this, both in terms of you now have to leave your home and go somewhere else and sit in another building or stand in another building or lift heavy objects or go to a work site, you're going somewhere else and you have demarcated hours. So now all of a sudden you couldn't pick up your little baby and hold her while you were cooking and doing other kinds of work or picking eggs or whatever you were doing. You had to find something else to do with that child if you were going to go to work. You couldn't weave those as easily. So at this time, we really developed in the United States and several other countries a norm of what we call separate spheres. These became increasingly separate spheres, which you can kind of see the seeds for work-life balance issues planted at that time when those were separated. So during this era, if you think about it, most of our large organizations in America, and even to some extent some of the smaller, mid-sized, long-term companies were founded in that era. And the jobs and the management was designed around this model of having somebody who was basically fully available to work during those demarcated hours and didn't have a lot of conflicts because somebody else was doing the work with children, with taking care of the home, with and community work as well, volunteering at schools and different other kinds of service like that. So during that separate spheres era, in organizations, the emphasis was on individual achievement and the ability to just provide economically for the family, for the worker, not to nurture, not to necessarily do physical care. That was done by other people, typically women. And it wasn't of direct concern to business. Other than they were concerned if you had a big family that you could support that family in order to keep you happy. So that was about the extent of the work family or the work-life concern that they had at that point in time. So that's kind of a real brief historical overview. And you can see some of the seeds for why this is an issue for us now planted back at that time. So we'll come back to that. So what happened? Well, in 1964, a lot of things were going on in the United States. But one of the things that went on was the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And the Civil Rights Act was passed in that year, and it protected against certain kinds of discrimination in any employment practices. And there were five categories in that law. Anyone know what those five categories are that were protected for employment practices, protected against discrimination? What were the categories of protection in 64? I know that's a long time ago.
Race was one.
Okay, race. Any other?
Sex.
Yeah, that one was in there. Sex, race, ethnicity, national origin, and religion. Those were the five. So there's an old story, and I never really did the journalistic work that it would take to see if this was true. Maybe you know if it's true. But I've heard this story several times. So it's either an urban legend or it's actually true. And the story is that during the civil unrest in the 1960s, a lot of this was racial unrest. And that the Civil Rights Act was originally drafted and gone through the process with the idea of protecting against racial discrimination primarily and religious discrimination. And the story goes that people who were very much against the bill said, well, throw sex in there and it's sure to be defeated. So that they actually put sex in there because they thought the bill would not pass then. And it did, much to their chagrin. And so now discriminatory practices in employment, I think it's Title 7 of the Title 4 of the Civil Rights Act, that year was guaranteeing protections against employment. And as a result, companies had to change their ways to some extent and hire women. Before that era, there were plenty of examples, and I know this seems like ancient history to most of you. The other day in my class, we were talking about great communicators, and people were talking about people who had a lot of charisma, like Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. And I was visiting in another professor's class, and I said, well, you better mention a Republican. What about Reagan? And this person in the back said, I was in diapers when Reagan was president. And I was like, oh, ouch. So I know this seems like ancient history, but some of us were around. So women entered the workforce in great numbers. And I think it's important to understand for everyone, especially for women who are entering businesses, where you're entering history. Because what's gone on in the immediate past very much has an impact on what you experience when you go in. And it's easy to kind of look around and say, like a fish in water, this is the way it's always been, or this is the way it is, and has to be. It's just, you know, on the eighth day, God created jobs this way. But actually, it's been an evolution, and it's something that has changed. And so in order to be able to understand how you fit in it, it can be helpful to understand how it got to be the way it is, I think. So that's why I'm giving you the little history lesson. And then we'll get to, given that we know this now, what can we do to build better lives for ourselves? So we'll definitely get to that as well, as I'm keeping my eye on the clock. So women entered the workforce in the 70s in huge numbers. It was a wave. And this is especially true for the privileged classes of women. Okay, so sometimes when I give a talk like this, I have some friends who study work family who are African American. And when we talk about this, they just laugh. Because guess what? African American women always worked. So this is a privileged perspective in many ways. This is when white middle class women also went to work and had to face the issues that many African American women had been facing and women of color had been facing for a long time. But like with many issues, it's when people of privilege have to face them that it starts to get talked about in the media more. So that was the case here too. Now, I started my real career, as I call it, about the mid-80s. And when I started, the norm was, well, if you wanted a career, you waited a long time to have kids. I didn't want to wait a long time to have kids. So once I started, I planned and did get pregnant relatively early. And as soon as they found out I was pregnant, they said, oh, you're going to be perfect to be on our women's studies committee, women's issues committee. You know, all these women are entering the workforce, and what we're realizing is that even though we're hiring them in greater and greater numbers, they leave, and we can't retain them. And so we want to study this issue, and hey, you're pregnant, get on this committee. And I said, okay, I didn't know. I was like 25 or something. And so I did. And that was probably my first professional entree into the field of work life, was being on this women's studies committee. And what I saw as I started to study these issues a little more, because this wasn't covered in my school, I never learned anything about it in my schooling, was that that became a sensitive issue, because they said, well, it's not just women who have these issues, other people have these issues too. So the field changed to work family. So for a long time, companies had work family programs. And then people said, well, there's a lot of people who don't want and don't have families, and they also want life, so how come they're not included? So the field changed to work life. And that's where we kind of are now. And I think that's both a good thing and a bad thing. I mean, on the one hand, it's great because it's much more inclusive. There are a lot of people who are child-free by choice and have no interest in having children, and more power to them, say I. At the same time, though, calling it work-life kind of hides that probably 85% of the issues that are involved in work-life have to do with mothering. The barriers that women face in organizations to advancing their careers and having equal pay tend to be mostly associated with mothering. So really, this field is a mix of this old term, this term, and this term. And I think, again, I'm glad it's broadened, but we have to now unpack it a little bit, because a lot of stuff has been shoved in there under the rubric work-life. So watching corporate America, I saw this evolution, and I started to do research. In 1994, when my first article in this field came out and I finished my dissertation, there were about two or three other people working on this. But it was not a big field within business management. In psychology, they were doing a little more with it. In sociology, they were doing a little more with it, but not in business. So I was able to get in on the front end of that, which was both a blessing and a curse, as any of the academics in the room understand. If you're doing work in a new area, it's tougher. But it was interesting to me. I think I got interested in this area for the same reason that somebody who's been divorced about 7 times then studies marriage counseling and becomes a marriage counselor, because I couldn't figure it out. So I thought, somebody out there must know how to do this. So why don't I go out and read the literature and figure out how this is done well? But if you look at this research that I'm talking about here, what it shows is that despite the fact that we now call it work life, for most people, at some point in their career, work family will be the two biggest things they're trying to balance. This doesn't mean that other things are unimportant, but it just acknowledges that these are still some of the big issues that people have to balance. And Much research shows that women are disproportionately affected by their work lives, in their work lives, by their family lives. And by the way, on the handout, I have all these resources listed on the back of that big complex diagram that we're going to get to at the end. So if you want to know where she's pulling this stuff from, those resources are there and you can look at those. The Williams book is especially instructive on explaining this whole system, I think, pretty well. So let's look at some of the early work that happened. I won't go into this in great depth, but because of the assumptions that were made under the separate spheres era, so back when you know, work, home and life were separated, we'd gotten so used to that over the last 100 years that when women entered the workforce, the first researchers to work on this said, well, there's going to be conflict here. When these two roles are being enacted by one person, well, there's just going to be conflict. Without even thinking, there could be positive things as well. So the early research, the first decade or so, was all about conflict. But more recent research, and this is even since 2000, I would say, has moved away from conflict and started to show what the benefits are of multiple roles and how much richer someone's life can be if they want multiple roles and get opportunities to be powerful and have control and autonomy and flexibility in all the roles that they engage in. So this is exciting to me because it goes from kind of casting this in a negative light, like, oh my God, I'm the woman juggling all the balls and how am I ever going to do it without dropping a bunch of them and not being able to make it, to more the yin and yang, wow, I've got all this stuff and it's a very rich and exciting life. And this stuff is finally now starting to come out in the research. So it's interesting how our researchers' lenses can filter what we look for when we study a phenomenon as well. So this recent work has talked a lot more about how it's important to have family supportive culture to facilitate the two areas working together. This research has shown that it's the quality of the roles and the support built into each system for the other system that determine whether more conflict or more enrichment results. This is the key finding I want to leave you with, and I'll talk about it in more detail. How many of you went to a career counselor in high school? Did you take the strong interest inventory or something? They told you artistic or investigative or whatever. And then you were supposed to choose your career. And they gave you this list, and usually people get PO'd. You know, it told me I should be a beautician and I don't want to be a beautician. Or, you know, told me I should be an accountant and I hate accounting. Those are interest match tests. Or you might have taken the Myers-Briggs, anyone? Some people have, and you can get a book called Do What You Are, which tells you the right careers for you based on your personality type. Those are all very helpful. At the same time, if you ever went to a marriage counselor, anyone? Premarital counseling for your church or something, a few of you, they'll talk about compatibility with your spouse and what kind of family you want to have, but never the two systems shall meet. So you're going around and you're going to the career counselor and then you're going over to the premarital counselor and nobody thinks to tell you, guess what? There's going to be an interaction between these two. So when you're choosing your career and you're choosing your life partner and whether you want to have kids, there might be some ties here. And this is where my model comes in, and it shows explicitly where research has shown those two affect each other. Now, I've been really talking to people mostly about family here, but I want to point out at this point that any significant commitment has the same kind of model. So cross off family if you're not interested in family, and put in community service, or put in I want to be a state senator, or put in My ethnicity is very important to me, and I'm involved in a lot of Danish pride organizations. Or I'm involved in the African American Student Association, and that's really important, my ethnic identity, or whatever it is. The same thing is going to be true for any significant involvement in more than one life era, because the systems were designed for people who didn't have that. This is why we struggle with this now. So one of my primary messages in terms of creating the life we envision is, when you're making choices in each of those different domains, recognizing and purposefully choosing things that are going to support and give you flexibility, control, and autonomy will make it easier to achieve that life balance. So this is some of the research that I'm really excited about, because living through this during the conflict era, when all corporate America was doing was trying to get rid of my conflicts, it's like, well, what can we do to make you into a guy with no conflicts? Let's see, how about on-site childcare? If you bring your kid here, then you never have to see him again, and you can be act just like that guy who was always available. Or, well, gee, you know, if we give you flexible days to take off when your child is sick instead of vacation, you get the same amount of time off, but now you, isn't that great? Now you can use them to take care of your sick child instead of having a vacation. Gee, thanks, corporate America, but that wasn't quite what I had in mind. So how do we really change the systems to be able to accommodate people who have significant interest in more than one life facet is really the bigger question that we're moving to now. So when you think about this, what are we talking about? Like I said, I've been sort of talking about life, family, work family, because family is one of the key things, and it's one of the biggest barriers for women in the workplace. But there's a lot of other things. Some people have furry kids. You may believe in volunteering. You may believe in working toward sustainability or other things that help the global community. You may have a lot of value on your spirituality or your religion. That's obviously a symbol that tries to incorporate a lot of the major world religions. So I use it to talk about spirituality, ethnicity, as I said before. Your health, you might care about that. Maybe you have an art. Maybe you want to play once in a while. Now, not everybody does. So one of the findings that is interesting is that there are subgroups of people who just want to work. And they say, work-life balance, no thanks. I want to be fully absorbed. And they're happier when they are. But the majority of people want some kind of balance or some kind of stability in something else besides their work. So my remarks, while they're focused on family, I do want to really emphasize that, you know, if you want to play, if you have a hobby, or if you have an art, or if you want to incorporate sustainability, well, sometimes you can merge these things so that your work has to do with your art, or your work has to do with improving the world, or your work has to do with your ethnicity, or your work has to do with health. But it's pretty hard to incorporate all your interests. So you may have several different dimensions that you're trying to balance. And again, just a little bit of research. For most people, the major life roles that they're trying to balance are listed here. Education, leisure or play, citizenship, work, keeping a home, which is different from keeping relationships. You can keep a spotless home and lose your husband or wife, right? Or your significant other or your kids. You can pay for a home and not get to know your kids because you're working so much. So there's a difference between the home and the marriage family, the friendships and peers, the ethnicity, the religion, and community. So from the research, these are the different pieces of life that the research has uncovered. So this series, the title of my talk was Work-Life Balance, Creating the Lives We Envision, but it's part of a greater justice in the workplace for women. So I want to just point out a few things about specifically for women. As Aaron said earlier, women comprise about half of the workforce now. The statistic is always changing. They hold 56% of all professional jobs, and they hold more and more jobs in business. Women of color represent about a third of all U.S. women now. And what we know is that the median weekly earnings of women who are full-time are about 81% of men's. And there's been a lot of studies to try to see if this is caused by women's time outside the workforce for maternity leaves and child rearing. And that controls for some of the differential, but not all of it. So there's something else going on there. Women of colors are even lower as a percentage of white men's wages. But mothers who work full-time earn approximately 60% of what fathers who work full-time earn. So you can see that the family piece and the kid piece really has an impact in some way or another. And this statistic still always blows my mind. The child-free women and child-free people who are child-free by choice rightly have created their own minority civil rights movement because so much of our society is oriented around people who plan to have kids. However, it is true that 90% of the women in the room at some point, if they're average, if it's an average group, will become mothers at some times during their lives. So there's been some innovative arguments if you're pre-law. Anyone pre-law? No lawyers in the room? Okay. Well, if you were, I would have said some lawyers are working on a theory that the very facts that mothers earn approximately 60% of what fathers earn, and 90% of women become mothers means that there is discrimination against mothers in the workplace, if not by intent, then by impact. So the impact is discriminatory, even if the intent was not to discriminate. So I want to whiz through some of this because I think you know a lot of these facts and get to the solutions. What can we do? All right. But real quick, 15% of Fortune 500 companies have women on their boards of directors. 15 CEOs out of 500 in the Fortune 500 are women. That's 3%. Now, I have a lot of fun with this because in my field, I'm listed on the College of Business website as the only expert in the whole college on gender issues. So whenever one of these CEOs gets fired or quits, and especially if two of them do it once, they call me and say, can you comment on the trend? Women are decreasing in, as you know, as corporate CEOs in the Fortune 500. And I always say, there's a story there, but the story is not that two people quit, it's that women as a whole only represent 3%. But the media likes these trends and changes. So they'll also call me sometimes if two women suddenly get named CEOs, what do you make of the increase in women? You know, it's like, well, it moved from 3.0 to 3.1. That's not a story, but I guess it is in the media. But clearly, there's still issues at the top. This one's interesting. 54% of female middle and senior managers are childless, but only 29% of males. That's probably not a coincidence. And we'll kind of whiz through some of these. I could talk at length about the voluntary nature of leaving the workforce, but I won't, because I want to get to our solutions. So what's contributing to this? Well, there are some things that are contributing. And I'm just going to whiz through these because, again, I want to get to the solutions. We know that women still do the second shift more than men do. In heterosexual couples, women do probably two hours a day more of work once they get home. So we're talking about picking up, cleaning up the dishes, changing diapers, putting kids to bed, doing homework or whatever it is. Sorry. None of this is news, probably. Although it is always a surprise. I work with a lot of young women, and I love working with young women and men. And many men have wonderful intentions that they're going to contribute equally, and many women marry these men. But they're always surprised to find out when the feces hits the fan, if you'll pardon my colloquialism. Somehow, that just doesn't end up always working out the way they thought it was going to. And they find themselves falling back into the roles that they felt, you know, maybe they were trained to do, or they were used to doing, or they saw their parents do. Some of you have seen your parents be very egalitarian, but many of us haven't. So we still tend to fall back in that. Here's something that I felt personally. When I was out, say we were out at Perkins with the kids, and my kids got a little rambunctious when they were toddlers, and they might run around or go, bah! Or something. Everyone looked at me. Nobody ever looked at my husband. They looked at me. And I felt that. You know, I felt that social pressure. So I think there's something to that. Women feel like, I have to do this. Everyone's watching to see how my kids turn out. And I've talked to a lot of fathers. I love men, by the way. Just coming out as loving men. And I talk to them all the time, and it's interesting the psychology when I talk to my women friends versus my male friends about the level and extent to which they feel responsible for their children. They both feel very responsible for their children, but the things that they focus on are different. The little day-to-day behaviors, women tend to get a little bit more worked up about. And here's another one that I just love. You know, I would change diapers all day, and then we'd have my family over, and my husband would change a diaper or two while I changed five, and they'd say, oh, he's such a good dad! And I'd be like, you know, what about me? We still do that. We expect women to do it, so we don't even notice it, and men get this praise for doing a piece of it. This all, and it's not their fault. They're not going around saying, yeah, I changed a diaper.
This is our society's unconscious expectations. But they reinforce that they have powerful impacts on us. They had powerful impact on me without me knowing it. So, you know, you've had talks about sexual harassment, sexual discrimination. There's a structural piece of this too. Men don't have equality in paternity leaves and lots of other leave-related things. And some new research has shown that, well, actually women have trouble giving up control when it comes to kids. You don't change the diaper right, or that's not the way you shake the bottle. That can tend to make men discouraged from trying early on. And if they're discouraged from trying early on, or they're not approved for it, well, the rest of society is telling them they don't have to do it, so it's really difficult to get into doing that. So there's a lot of things going on here. There's two key elements going on with the family piece. One is the ideal worker, which we talked about. Works and careers were designed for people who didn't have a primary involvement in some other area. But also, dependent care in America is very privatized. Most of you know in Europe, there's a more active interest in everyone's children as an asset of that country. And so there's more investment in leaves so parents can take better care of their children, and more investment, and they have higher taxes too, so this is a trade-off. But this is actually the fact that for a developed country, we privatize child care and elder care. Parents with Alzheimer's, you got to take care of them yourself, unless they're poor, in which case they can go on Medicare and those kinds of things. But in general, this is privatized. And so these two things combined play in. So it's very complex. So now hopefully I haven't completely depressed you about this, but there are national and organizational things that that play into this. And what I want to spend just a few minutes talking about and then take your questions is, what can families do and what can individuals do? Because a lot of the systems, I don't know, when I was 25, I didn't feel very empowered to change these. If you do, I don't want to discourage you. If you are an activist and you want to work in corporations and you want to change them, we need you. Please do it. But in the meantime, what can you do on an individual level? If you look at that big, long, complex diagram that I gave you, I'm going to talk through different pieces of that, because within that are some ideas for how you can go about making choices in your life that you may not realize at the time, but research shows will have a big impact on whether you're able to have work-life balance or not. And it's bringing those two systems together. Well, one thing we can do is opt out and say, well, I'm just going to work and I'm not going to have a life. I'm not going to have balance. I don't want that. Or we can say, well, I'm going to just stay home and take care of my kids and let somebody else worry about work. And those are legitimate choices that people make every day, but there are risks to them. And I won't go into all the risks, but sometimes people don't realize until they get into their 40s and 50s that they made it as far as they can in work and they have nothing else in life. And there's a lot of research that suggests that men who took that route, who didn't know their children, and who lost their wives, have a lot of regret and loneliness. So making that choice is okay for a period of time, but just be aware of the risks of all work. And similarly, you all know the risks of all family. If you decide to stay home with the kids, I think that's an admirable choice. However, you're at risk. Because if he leaves, or if your partner leaves, maybe you have a female partner, and she's the primary breadwinner. You choose to stay home with the kids, she leaves, whoever your partner is, if they're the ones that are involved in work, the way our legal system is set up now, they get to take most of the goodies with them. This is why we have more older women in poverty than we have older men, and you all probably have heard the correlation between single mothers and poverty. This guy has done a lot of research on this, and he has shown that divorced women are especially vulnerable to poverty. And his bottom line is he recommends women find a good job that pays a decent salary with good health and pension benefits. Insure yourself somehow. The best way is to have a career and a job. So you can choose these, but be very careful about knowing what risks you're taking if you choose one of these or the other. But how, if you do choose both, what are some things that you can do to try to balance this? There are several things, and I know I have to break for questions pretty soon, don't I? Do I have 2 more minutes? Okay. So what can we do? One of the things that helps is to clarify your personal values. Sometimes we tend to fall into life and take the first job that comes along without really thinking, how is this going to fit with my life? Or we fall in love and we marry someone without really thinking, how much does this person support my life and what I want to do. So being very clear at this point before you take on huge commitments can really help you make those commitments wisely. And a lot of work has shown this in a lot of different realms of life. Figure out what you want your future to look like. So if you're 25 now, what do you want it to look like when you're old and gray like me at 45? And start making choices that support that very intentionally. Here's one that I love, and this gets at the balance issue. I think one of the things we have to face if we want to be hugely involved in more than one life arena is that something has to go. When I was 25, I thought I could have it all and do it all well. I failed to understand that there are limits in my days on time, on absolute minutes, and I couldn't do it all well. I had to give some things up. Some people might give up work. Some people might give up family. Those were both very important to me. So when I went through and clarified my personal values, I absolutely did not want to be economically dependent on anyone. I wanted to make sure that I could support myself so that I had freedoms to make choices from a place of power for myself. That's what I needed. Everyone's different, but that's what I needed. And I also wanted kids, and I wanted them before I was old and gray. I wanted kids when I was young. And those were important to me. And I had to make sacrifices on other things because I made those choices. So what I kept telling myself is I'm choosing to have my kids young for a reason, but a lot of friendships I had to kind of let them weaken. My health, you might have noticed, isn't as good as it could be. But I have a lifetime to develop those other things as well. So think about this as a long life course to get involved in these different things. Maybe if I want to do more community service, I can do that now that my daughter's a senior. Learn to delegate. Maybe your spouse won't diaper the baby the same way, that's okay. If the baby is safe and alive, that's a good thing. Same at work. Don't feel you have to take on every single duty. Learning to delegate is an important skill. And also cross-training. It's good to specialize, and the old model said people should specialize in what they're good at and therefore gain the efficiencies. The problem with that is if that person isn't at work, then the whole organization falls apart. If that person's not at home, the baby goes undiapered. If more people know how to do your job at work, you'll have more flexibility to come in and out. If more people know how to do your job at home, you'll have the flexibility to come in and out. Always, always, always develop more skills and more social and professional and personal resources. The more support you have and purposefully develop, the more you're going to be able to have a full, rich work-life balance. All this stuff takes communication and loving communication, whether at home and at work. So develop your skills for negotiation. This is going to be tough. You're going to be working with people at work that have to make trade-offs with you and people at home. I'm going to run through these real quick and then let you ask some questions. Here's some things that can really help, and studies have shown that if you have these things in your work organization, you tend to have lower levels of work-family conflict and higher levels of feeling that yin-yang richness of the full set of roles that you have. I will be happy to send these slides to anyone who wants them. My email is on the sheet. So if you want some of these solutions and you can't write fast enough, especially since I mistimed my presentation, I'm sorry about that. I will send you these slides. So these are some of the things, and they're listed to some extent on that complex diagram that I gave you. And similarly, things that help at home, whether you want a partner or not, but your support system, consider the gender-related values that match yours. Consider general values generally. You want someone who's fits with you in lifestyle. You don't want to go around picking up other people's stuff. It'll start to wear on you. Supportive and flexible, matches what you want. A lot of the same things. But the main point is, when you're making decisions in these two different realms, consider the other one if you want to be able to have that work-family balance. You'll still have some of this, but hopefully you can also get a little bit of this. And with that, I'll say thank you and take just a few questions. I'm sorry for going over my time. Are there any questions that anyone has? We do have 2 minutes. You can't leave for 2 minutes, so you might as well ask a question. They told you in the beginning, no leaving early, and I'm paying attention. I'm writing down names. Yes, sir?
I had a question. I listened to you say that the women entered the workforce in the 1970s, and you mentioned that colored women didn't had been working. So I was kind of wondering, when did the colored women actually enter the workforce, saying like big corporations? I was kind of wondering when.
That's a great clarification question. The question was, earlier I said that, and I had a bullet point slide that said women entered the workforce in the 1970s. They entered the workforce from being at home, doing unpaid work. The difference for many colored women, not all, is that they were already working. They may not have been working in corporate America. So they entered corporate America probably after white women did, but they were already doing work family, because often they were doing work for other people's families, or they were working in their family business, or those kinds of things, whereas a lot of the middle class white women stayed home and took care of kids full time. So that's the difference. Thank you for that. Yeah. Yep. So one way to look at that is as a percent of the population, are they represented in at every level of the organization? So if women of color are 8% of the U.S. population, then they should be 8% at every level of the organization. And very similar, not quite as good a results as for white women, but in terms of entering corporate America, they are in the same proportion as they are in the population, but probably even worse results the higher you get up. So you saw women in general, only 3% of CEOs in the Fortune 500, and women of color, there might be one. So it's even less represented. Thank you for those questions. Any other questions? All right, I'm sorry for going right up to the time.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for listening.